that's right. It's only 3:37 in the afternoon, but we are doing a special Meet Me at the Diner. We were able to corral the one and only Congressman Jeff Duncan with us for an hour this afternoon. We're going to follow him up with Jill Bossie from 4:30 to 5:30. And just of note, just a little while ago, I was talking to Thomas Ravenel, but you won't be able to hear that interview till Thursday. But this is politics season. Congressman Jeff Duncan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Great to be back in the studio with you, Ann.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
I don't know. It hadn't been that long, but yeah.
And it's been a long time since you've sat down across.
Probably, right? Yeah, sat in the studio.
Yeah, that's right.
You're right. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here. We've made some improvements, you can see, since the last time
and
you
I
were
like
here.
And I like what I see. I wondered about this will over here, and for the will of fortune for WCRS, but you won't let me spin it.
No, I won't. I'm sorry.
I wanted the grab bag, the candy bag, rather.
Yeah, so. I'm telling you, it's not for politicians. So you were up in Ware Shoals today.
I was just a little while ago. They've got a writing program that actually is administered through Clemson University, and I'm sure there's some federal money. They came to visit with me in Washington in April, and I said, well, I'd love to come visit. You know, I like to write. My son is at Clemson in the education program. He's a big writer, so I wanted to see what they're doing at my alma mater.
Yeah. Ware Shoals certainly has come a long way in the last few years. I had the opportunity to have Kay Sprouse on talking about the reorganization and some of the things that she has instituted there, excuse me, that has made some big differences in the Ware Shoals school system.
They have. Faye Sprouse has done a great job. The board there has done a great job. It was neat to be back at the school. I was only there my senior year of high school, but the memories came flooding back from the lockers in the hallway that were brand new in 1983 when I was there. To the auditorium and just the creak of the floors. And so what a great historic school. I was there for the Lou Brissy dedication for the field out, that was November a year ago. And you think about the history around that school and the fact that I graduated there, and I'm probably the only congressman that graduated from Ware Shoals.
So that's quite an honor.
For me, it is. Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Well, you know, there is so much going on. You are up for re-election.
I am.
And, of course, there's so many different issues to talk about here. I think we just ought to jump right in and start talking about some of these issues that are out there.
Absolutely.
You know, being on Homeland Security Committee, one of the things that, you know, you wonder about and you hear inklings about, but I'm not sure we actually ever hear any figures or numbers, is are there ISIS people coming across our borders?
We don't know.
We don't know.
Because we have a poor southern border, we have no idea who's in our country. They can say the other than Mexicans, OTMs, what the department calls them, they can say based on their apprehension rate and the percentages of the apprehensions being OTMs, they can say, well, we believe the ones that actually get across based on the same percentage, but they don't know. And so we've had this dialogue with Secretary Johnson and our committee just this past summer as we looked at ISIS and as we looked at the border and the immigration issue as a whole.
Didn't I hear that right around 9/11 we had some in the back of a car, in the trunk of a car, come across?
We've had that happen numerous times. In fact, there was a gentleman who actually got to, I believe, either Washington State or Minnesota, and he crossed the border in the back of a car. He actually went on to have a business there that funneled money to Hezbollah. And that's an existing case. I don't have all the details right on the top of my head, but so there's been numerous instances. As far as 9/11, I'm not sure, but I remember right after that up in the Seattle area coming across from Canada, there was an instance, I believe, about a trunk being involved. So.
You know, but one of the things that there's a lot of conversation about, do you believe it is the right thing for us to be over there in the Middle East?
Well, that's a philosophical debate that's been going on a long time. I do know this. We spent a lot of American blood and a lot of American treasure liberating Iraq from Saddam Hussein and oppression, giving them the opportunity to have self-governance. And now we see this this threat of ISIL come through from Syria and really wanting to reestablish that Levant or that caliphate. And they're threatening Baghdad now. We see the Kurds being the only group after the Iraqi army cut and ran. We're seeing the Kurdish folks be the only folks that have actually stood up to ISIL and actually taken it to them. They retook Mosul down. They retook Mosul. They're now being challenged up in the northern part. But I believe, knowing the Kurds, well, I've been there twice. I've met with them. They're friendly. They love America. They're allies. We didn't lose a single American life in that part of Iraq during either the 1990 war or the war on terror in Iraq. So I think we ought to be supporting them. And it hurts my heart to think about the number of soldiers, men and women, airmen, Marines, that lost either limbs, their lives, or have come back from that theater with PTSD and other issues, and we're watching ISIL basically overtake the area they fought for. It hurts me.
So do you think we should be? I mean, do you think the airstrikes are enough?
I don't think. I never have thought airstrikes were enough. I think you are going to have some element of boots on the ground, and the sooner we can do that, the better. But I'm talking about Iraq. I'm not talking about Syria. Syria is embroiled in a civil war, and I think getting involved in someone's civil war, especially where we don't know who the good guys and the bad guys are, they're pretty much, in my opinion, all bad guys. And so I voted against the president's plan to arm and fund the yet-to-be-named Syrian rebels that were going to go against Bashar Assad. Got those backwards. So I don't believe we ought to be in Syria. But Iraq is a whole different ball game, as far as I'm concerned, just because of our involvement in it. And a lot of people can say our withdrawal in 2011 to meet a presidential election campaign promise, premature withdrawal from Iraq. I was there in November of 2011. We pulled out by December 31st. I didn't think then, I don't think now, we were ready to pull out. I don't think the Iraqis were ready for self-governance and self-defense and border security and all the things they needed to do.
Now, what do you think about Turkey in this whole picture here? We're not really getting a strong feeling with where Turkey falls in this.
Right. Well, I met with Prime Minister Erdogan in May, mm-hmm. and in Ankara, and we had a long conversation about their involvement. I talked with him personally about Israel trying to make amends over the flotilla raid, but I think he's not friendly to America. I would point directly to him. And really, it's not that much about America. It's more about, to throw the Kurds back into this, it's more about their fear of the PKK or the Kurdish party, the big Kurdish population in, I guess that would be eastern, southeastern Turkey. And they're fearful. Erdogan is fearful of the Kurds. And so I think that's a big part of his decision making. You got to understand that Turkey is a Muslim country. It is 99.something% Islamic. In fact, in Istanbul, you really can't look anywhere without seeing a mosque and minarets on the horizon. They're everywhere. Kind of like Baptist churches in the South.
There you go. All right. Well, so it looks like we're not really. Are we making a lot of progress now?
No, I think airstrikes are. You know, they're taking a toll on some supply routes and maybe some logistics and maybe some command structure. But at the end of the day, ISIL would not be threatening Baghdad if airstrikes were effective. You're going to have to put some sort of force on the ground, whether that's a coalition force, whether that's a U.S. force.
Do we really have a coalition forces, though?
Yeah, it's very fractured.
I don't really see that the strong relationships like we've had in the past with our allies.
And in this case, it's because of the Islamic nature of it. Although the Islamic state in Iraq and Syria is not Islamic, according to the president, and that was a crazy statement by him. But you look at Saudi and UAE and the others, Egypt to some degree, that have helped us in these airstrikes against ISIL. But then you think about it, it took England a long time to come to the table to help with airstrikes. It didn't France for a reason that baffles me to this day, but Germany, Italy, Spain, our historic allies, are not there. And I think, Anne, it really comes down to the burgeoning Muslim populations within their own borders that they've got to tread lightly politically because there's a political dynamic. And you think about why that's a dynamic. You've got to go back and think it's a failed immigration policy because the Germans, the Brits, the Spaniards, the Italians, the French even did not want to do the menial labor jobs. And so they started bringing North Africans, Moroccans, and Algerians in, and later Pakistanis and others, to do those hospitality, horticulture type jobs. So that failed immigration policy that created these large populations, they're now having to contend with. Think about where we are with regard to immigration and southern border and failed immigration policies that could affect the political dynamics at some point in the future.
Absolutely. You know, speaking of that, Jeff, one of the things that really bothers me is all the children that came across the border back there during the summer months.
Right. There were more than just children. You know, 87% of these children were between the ages of 14 and 17. Those are young adults in Latin America. And a lot of them had gang ties. You know, I'm very, from a humanitarian side, you know, I'm very, passionate about trying to help those children. Mm-hmm. For some reason, they were sent here by their parents, either for opportunity, either to escape some sort of oppression, or I don't know.
I find it hard to believe, though, that they could make it all the way from point A to point B across our southern border without some direction from somewhere.
Yeah, they had what they call them mules or others. I'm concerned that they were cartel routes and drug smugglers that were involved. And here's the other thing to throw into that mix is that if a child can make it from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, all the way, 1,500 plus miles, and I used a laser pointer to show how far that was on a map in a committee hearing one day. If a child can make it that far, I guarantee an ISIL terrorist or an Al-Qaeda terrorist, and ISIL is just a fragmented portion of Al-Qaeda, could make it here. And this is the soft underbelly of our nation, is our poor southern border, and we need to be cognizant of that.
Well, you know, and that brings us to the point, though. Well, what about all these children that have been put in all these school systems all across our country? Should not these children be sent back?
I think they should. I think the best signal is a plane returning back to Guatemala with the children that were just sent here and the parents that just paid thousands of dollars to transport them here. So I think they should. I am against illegal.
So why don't we do this?
I'm against illegal immigration because we have an administration that won't enforce the current laws on the books. And so this undocumented minor children should be reunited and repatriated in their country. I'm concerned about them attending
schools. Your opponent
thinks
that we should take them all in, that they are all been abused and whatnot, and we should take them all in and make them part of our country.
Well, he thinks that about any illegal that comes into this country. He thinks we should grant just carte blanche amnesty and assimilate everyone. And I disagree. I think we're a sovereign nation, and we can determine who comes into our country, how many come every year, what they come for, how long they stay, and whether we make them citizens or not. You know, I believe my citizenship has a certain value, and I think you have to earn that value. I mean, something earns worth more any day of the week than something given. And it's just like if you go and buy something with your hard-earned money, you take care of it a little bit better than maybe that gift. And so I look at it in those simple terms. But bottom line is we're a sovereign nation. We ought to be able to determine. We shouldn't allow outside forces to determine who comes into this country, how many, and how long they stay. We should determine that. And that's part of the electoral process. And America spoke, I think, fairly loudly that they didn't want this immigration bill that passed out of the Senate. The House was taken over by Republicans. We put a stop to it, and hopefully we're going to continue to put a stop to it. Now, we need to have a conversation about immigration issues, not immigration reform, let me be clear, but immigration issues in this country at some point in time. But we can't even have that conversation today because Americans do not trust their government to actually do what they say they're going to do. We've got laws on the books that say you should secure the border. We've got laws, 2006 of Secure Fence Act said you're going to build a fence or more of a fence. Hadn't been funded by Congress, hadn't been done. Immigration and Customs Enforcement laws that are on the books that the administration doesn't enforce. And you could, there's a myriad of, a whole litany rather, of examples there. So
why should we believe in any of you guys?
Well, there's a group of us that are passionate about doing what we say we're going to do.
But but it doesn't happen.
But if we pass laws out of Congress and the president chooses not to enforce them, that's where the change has to be made. I'm a legislator. All I can do is pass laws, and I can hold the agencies that we have oversight over accountable. We've had numerous oversight hearings in the committee that I'm on. I think that's the proper role. But at some point, we've got to look at separation of powers. We've got to look at delving into other responsibilities, the executive branch legislating through Obamacare and that agency, actually writing regulations and rules. And we've got to figure out a way to force the administration, whether it's this administration or another, to actually enforce the laws that are on the books. And if you disagree with those laws, then convince Congress to change the law. That's how the process is supposed to work.
Okay. So it doesn't, I mean, did you fund money for, since Congress is the funding end of it, did we fund money to build a fence?
We should.
Did we? Did we? Did
No,
we fund money?
we have not.
Why not?
Because there are priorities on both sides of the aisle. We're operating under a continuing resolution. We shut the government down because we didn't want to fund another facet. So it is my desire to actually fund the laws, to fund to build the fence. But when you've got Harry Reid in the Senate stopping 360 bills that the House has passed and over the Senate, they just go and file 13. They never see the light of the Senate floor. We see the Senate only passing things that have to pass Congress in order to keep the government open or reauthorize certain programs that are expiring. That's the only thing that's passed the Senate for the most part in 4 years that I've been there.
And yet you passed a continuing resolution back, what, first part of September,
In the
end of
end of
August.
September, yeah,
End
about the
of,
end of September.
wasn't it first part of September?
Yeah,
End of August, first part of
the
September?
last week we were there, one of the last things we did, and I'd have to look back at the calendar, but it expired on September 30th, and that's why that date's sticking in my head.
And yet we all authorized money to be spent for the airstrikes, correct?
They did, yes.
Yes. So we spent money for that, but we can't secure our borders. And what about all these other government agencies that just keep ticking off and spending lots of money?
Guess what? There's
What?
57,000 federal employees that were sent home, mostly for disciplinary action, that are at home, still drawing a paycheck,
Why?
to the tune of about $800 million, just short of
Okay.
$1 billion,
Why?
because of the past rulings and other things that keep us from being able to fire the bureaucrats. There's a lot of changes. America needs to realize that there's a lot of government waste and a lot of government wasteful spending, but when you can't fire the three or four people that have culpability in Benghazi of not securing the American personnel there, and they can't be fired and actually given new jobs within the Department of State, and we got 57,000 federal employees that aren't working, that are at home, who knows what they're doing, but they're still drawing a paycheck. Lois Lerner being one of them who has
I thought she had
culpability in
retired.
that.
Yeah, I thought she had actually, hadn't she retired?
She finally did, but she
yeah
was getting a $100,000 pension,
right
and she has some culpability in this push against
the IRS
conservatives. So.
right, but Jeff, if these things are true, as you say, and I don't doubt that they are true, how are things going to change? You know, I talk to people every day who talk for smaller government. We need smaller government. My contention is that the federal government is so overblown and so it has a life of its own. It can any group, I don't care, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Libertarian, whatever group you want to call it, or a conglomerate of all, can they actually come together and make a change because the federal government has such a life of its own? Should we
Yeah.
move to Nashville and start over?
I don't think so. You know, regardless of what political banner you fly under, we're all Americans, and we can solve this. You know, we fought
We
two.
haven't, though.
Yeah. Well, it takes a political will to do that, and it takes people willing to cast votes regardless of the political outcome. You know, I haven't cast votes that are popular with one side of the spectrum. I haven't cast votes that are popular with everybody. I've cast votes that I think are important for returning America to that constitutional government, that 17 enumerated powers that government's supposed to do, and everything else is relegated to the states or us. And so, you know, it's going to take more like-minded people. It's going to take the electorate rising up. You know, we've got this, I talk about this a good bit, but we've got this 24/7 news cycle now that exacerbates any sort of confrontation in Congress between the two parties and makes it seem like it's never been there before, that it's worse than it ever has. And I point to Fisher Ames, a founding father, signed the Constitution, served in Congress for 3 terms, 6 years. And before he left, he said, "Do not ask what good we do, for that is not our fair question in these days of faction." He said, "Don't ask what good we're doing in Congress. That's not fair of you to ask me that question in these days of partisanship and faction." That was in 1796 or 1797. And so it's been there. right now it's just in your face 24/7. I'm on the news loop, on, you know, all the cable channels, in your face on the internet, emails, text, everything.
So if we didn't have the news, you don't think
I'm just saying that it's trying to keep everything exacerbated and stirred up, because that's ratings, that's viewers, that's filling airtime. I mean, the 24/7 loop, you got to do a lot of reporting. Right. And so you watch any of them, CNN or Fox, they're going to report the same thing over and over and over and over.
Sure.
And so anyway, I'll just say that it's there. We got to figure out a way to work in that.
Well, I think, you know, most of us sit there, whether we're watching Fox or CNN or a combination of both, or MSNBC or whatever your pleasure is, we, the people down here at the bottom rung, don't see the movement. We see every once in a while you'll see a glimmer of hope, and then it's dashed.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, because you hear, what do they call Congress now? I'm just going to ask you, what do they call Congress now?
The Do-Nothing Congress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let me give you the facts. The House passed over 360 bills over to the United States Senate. Wait a second. The House has passed over 360 bills over the United States Senate that have gone nowhere.
Right.
These are bills to roll back regulation, to reduce your taxes, to reduce government involvement in whether it's Obamacare or other parts of your life. That's American energy independence issues. It's all these things to get government kind of slimmed down and headed in the right direction. And the Senate will not take those up because we're a divided Congress. Harry Reid has been the effective veto for the Obama administration, who hasn't issued a single veto in his presidency. He didn't have to when Pelosi and Reid ran the show over there, but now he doesn't have to because Harry Reid's not allowing anything to pass the Senate that he doesn't agree with.
And so the answer is that Republicans have to take the Senate in order to make something happen.
Well, I hope that's what happens. I would just go back to the Do-Nothing Congress and say we've been very prolific in the House. I hadn't been set up there twiddling my thumbs or playing congressional. We've been working, and we've had the appropriate oversight hearings on the agencies, in our committees. We've had the appropriate markup. We've had the appropriate floor debate. We've actually had the process as our founders envisioned on the House side, and the Senate fails back. So if the Senate is taken by Republicans, I hope we continue and pass a lot of these bills that we've already passed. I realize they won't be as conservative as me, but there will be Republican-flavored bills. Send them to the president and let the president make a decision for once. So you can either veto them or you can sign them. If he signs them, we've got Republican law on the books that maybe we can get enforced, go back to the earlier. But if he vetoes it, then America will see that dichotomy between Republican governance and progressivism.
All right. Hey, I tell you what, we're going to be here another whole half hour with Congressman Jeff Duncan. I certainly hope you're going to be able to stay with us, but right now it is time for Top of the Hour News and a word from our sponsors. You are listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. We'll be back. Hey, if you got a question for Congressman Jeff Duncan, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
Gold. Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're back here this afternoon with Congressman Jeff Duncan, who is drinking his Sonic drink. Now, what's in that drink there? It's a big one. Let me tell you that, folks.
This is Sprite Zero with grape flavor, and I just want you to know it's happy hour at Sonic, so this is half price.
That's right.
And that's why your fiscal conservative congressman has this drink in his hand, because it's half price.
There you go. All right. Well, he's enjoying himself, that is for sure. You know, Jeff, we were talking off air about term limits, and of course you said that basically if everybody would be term limited, that's where you would be with that.
Yeah, and I've signed on to, you know, numerous bills in my tenure in Congress to put term limits there. Something I believe in, but they should apply to everybody. Why should the good guys leave and keep the, you know, why should
because
I
Because that's
Craig
what
Gowdy,
always happens in an organization.
Yeah,
the good
guys,
always leave an organization,
leave.
And the people that just are there just stay there because they're collecting a paycheck.
So I'll use one name. I'll use Trey Gowdy. Why should Trey Gowdy term limit himself and leave Congress and leave a guy like Harry Waxman or Elijah Cummings or someone like that in charge? And he shouldn't. And so if it applied to Henry Waxman or Nancy Pelosi or Elijah Cummings, just like it applies to Jeff Duncan, Trey Gowdy, Mick Mulvaney, Tim Scott, then okay. But the problem is self-imposed term limits do not work because the good guys go take another job somewhere and the people there running the hen house or whatever. So,
would you see something like that happening if the Senate becomes Republican?
I think term limits have more of a chance there. I think fair tax has more of a chance, a flat tax, a change in the tax code in general. I think a rollback of some of the Obamacare mandates that we think we can get the president signed. I think they all have more of a chance with more like-minded people there.
Sure. Now, speaking, okay, we talked about term limits. Now, another big conversation that's going on out there that seems to create quite a rise is when we talk about raising the minimum wage, this living wage, $10.10 an hour, and the good things it would bring to businesses if they would pay their people more. Where do you think there are people out there actually working long time at minimum wage?
No. Minimum wage is an entry-level wage, and anybody that's ever created a job or studied business knows that. You know, high school students go into a job making minimum wage. The thing is, if you raise a minimum wage, you're going to have businesses out there that are operating right now on very razor-thin margins that will go out of business. And the net effect will be fewer jobs for people that are unemployed now. What we need is more labor participation. We need more people to seek the jobs. We do that by rolling back some of the government benefits they're able to get. And try to foster an employment situation and job creators, foster that innovative and entrepreneurial spirit, you know.
Well, that's pretty much been taken out of us, let me tell you, Jeff. I mean, I feel very whipped, you know, as far as an employer and a business person.
I can only imagine. Yeah. I was an employer for a while. I had my own business for 16 years, and we weren't large, but I had to do all the paperwork. You know, for one employer, 10, I got to do all those reports.
Right.
And so whether it's matching Social Security, Medicare, and recording all that and sending it in, and unemployment, and all the things that we had to do as a small business, whether you have one or 10. And so it takes a lot of time. And then we've had numerous conversations with businesses just in the last week or so about all the time they are spending just trying to comply with Obamacare or figure out Obamacare, or figure out what they're going to do for their employees, what they're going to be mandated to do, what's the law look like today because it's been rolled out so slowly with delays in certain mandates. And so we just had a conversation with a staffing company here who, you know, they cannot figure out how to price their services to the companies that they provide employees for because they don't know. The future is so uncertain. Government owes you the responsibility for being certain. We ought to put some certainty. What are your electrical rates going to be? Do away with cap and trade. Do away with the attack on coal and things that actually work. Do away with all this litigation like NLRB that's affecting business. Do away with the EPA cram down of regulation after regulation after regulation. Put some certainty in tax policy, lower our corporate rate. Do away with some loopholes. I'm fine with that. The president wants to do away with loopholes because closing loopholes provide more money for him to spend. I want to do with loopholes. I want to simplify the tax code and make it more attractive for employers to locate here and hire employees and keep those businesses here versus like a Burger King that left to Canada. Canada, 15% corporate tax rate. We're at 35. Take the loopholes out. We're at 35. They're at 15. That's the starting point. And so let's allow repatriation of overseas earnings. Let's allow just a lot of things. So I think we've got to put some certainty back in the marketplace. There's so much uncertainty right now.
Sure. And I think a lot of people are sitting on the sidelines saying, I'm not going to get involved, or I'm not going to make that improvement to my business. I'm not going to go out and hire those extra people because they just don't have any belief of what they're paying today will be what they're paying 3 months from now or 6 months or a year from now.
That's right. They're used to making five-year plans with some certainty that the game isn't going to change that rapidly, that maybe 3 years in the five-year plan, but at least be able to plan with some sort of certainty. They can't do that now, and it's all short-term planning or no planning at all, and that's dangerous.
And the other thing is the tie-up of our banks.
Yeah.
I mean, we have no ability to fund and do things the way we were able to do things.
Yeah, the whole Dodd-Frank legislation is a time for a whole nother segment here, but what it does to local lenders who have to have capital requirements and aren't able to loan certain percentages, and it's tough for folks out there right now to borrow the money necessary to improve their business, expand their business, hire new employees, or start a new business. I can't imagine trying to start a new business in this climate trying to go to a bank. Now, you might be able to get mom and dad or friends and family and
raise
some
capital. And that's where a lot of people have gone now.
Absolutely. But how much capital is out there after the 2008 downturn? Have we gotten back to where there's enough capital out there? And that's a rhetorical question.
Sure. Absolutely. All right. Well, we are here with Congressman Jeff Duncan. I want to ask you, I've got a lot more questions to ask you, actually. But right now, let's hear a quick word from our sponsors. We'll come back. Don't you go away.
Do you remember? Well, now more than ever, we all need a break. And your local McDonald's wants you to remember the good times and come to McDonald's to enjoy the dollar menu, their new Angus burger, their salads, and of course, their coffees. From lattes to cappuccinos, they want you to locally owned right here in Greenwood and Abbeville. Stop by today.
All right, we're back here with Congressman Jeff Duncan. You know, Jeff, I asked you off the air what you think were the most important things out there to discuss. You brought up...
Well, I first said the most important thing is winning the Senate, but then I talked about safety and security, Ebola and ISIL, and we haven't talked enough about that. And people are more fearful today about their safety and security than they were just a few short years ago, even just a few short months ago, because of ISIL and the potential threat, understanding our poor southern border because we saw children able to come here and they're worried about terrorists coming here. And then we see Ebola, and we see also intravirus, 98 or whatever, that's is causing some sickness and death with children. That's a concern. Does that tie in the immigration issue? And that's a rhetorical question. But so we got a poor southern border, soft underbelly of the nation. We've got a terrorist threat that does want to hurt America, and that's with ISIL and Al-Qaeda still being prevalent. But we also have a infectious disease, Ebola, and we don't know what we don't know about Ebola. We think we know it's a virus, but we don't know. Is it mutating? Can it be spread by airborne? I do know what works, and that is closed borders and quarantine. Those are two simple things that the neighboring countries, neighboring in Africa, neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone and the other West African countries that have Ebola outbreaks, they've shut their borders down. They don't allow anybody from those countries to travel. They also allow quarantine to happen, you know, for a minimum of 21 days. I point everybody to an NPR story about Firestone. Bridgestone Firestone located in Edgefield, but the Firestone plantation that harvests rubber. They have like a mill town. We're used to mill towns here. It's like a mill town. They have a town. They have a rubber plantation. Everybody in town goes out and works on the plantation, comes home. They've been able to effectively stop Ebola from taking over in their town, in Liberia, right outside on the outskirts of Monrovia, the capital city, by basically sealing their borders and quarantine. It works. So we should stop all flights into this country. We should halt all visas of people traveling. We probably should still allow missionaries and healthcare workers to travel to West Africa. That's a humanitarian side. But they need to go with an understanding that if they do go, they come back and they're quarantined at some facility for a minimum of 21 days before they're able to
What about sending the military over there, Jeff?
I disagree with that. We're willing to send 3,000 men from the 101st Airborne, by the way, into Liberia, but we won't send those same people that are trained to fight and defend our country into Iraq to go against this threat there. And so it seems like our priorities are upside down. I'm concerned that we're sending those military men facing an infectious disease. It could be deadly. They could bring home and spread to their other people in their platoon or their regiment, or they could spread to their family. If they go to Iraq and they fight ISIL and they come home, they're not bringing ISIL with them and threatening their family or their platoon mates. And so I think there's a big, big difference there.
You know, we've talked about all these things, but really it seems to me it comes back to our president. President Obama just does not react to things and make things happen. He seems to wait too long. He's always surprised by things. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, first off, he's very indecisive to begin with. He's not a true leader, never has really experienced skills beyond being able to be a good campaigner and communicator and persona. And so, you know, I point to the fact that he doesn't do a daily briefing every day. He prefers to read everything on his iPad. Well, communication and understanding is back and forth communication.
Sure.
That's inflection of voice. That's emphasis. That's questioning for extrapolating more information.
Sure.
or clarification. He doesn't get that. I think he's missing a whole element of your daily briefing, and I think that leads to his being caught flat-footed or not having all the information. Well, you probably had it. You probably just didn't get it. So I point to his failure in leadership skills to being a big part of this.
Well, I am really quite tired, actually, of the president making comments like, if he said he liked apple pie, Republicans would hate apple pie. I mean, his offhanded comments all the time.
He's totally wrong. You know, I've been able to give him credit where credit was due. I passed a transboundary hydrocarbon agreement language that actually implemented an agreement between the United States and Mexico that Hillary Clinton put forth in Cabos in February of 2012. And so we waited for implementing language, and Ken Salazar, Department of Interior, wouldn't send us implementing language, so I wrote it, actually got it in the omnibus last year. So we actually are going to see a lease sale and 1.5 million brand new acres in the Gulf of Mexico. So I give him credit. They got something right there. Now, you could say that's ultra deep water. That's deeper than Deepwater Horizon. So the administration is embracing deep water drilling.
Right.
But yet, they'll say we shouldn't have any more offshore drilling. Won't allow us to drill off the coast of South Carolina where the water's shallow, 120 feet deep versus 5,600 or deeper Gulf of Mexico. So, you know, there seems to be some hypocrisy there. And I think Americans are seeing a lot of hypocrisy come out of this administration.
Yeah, I think it's a shame. I think a lot of people
You can have windmills, but if you're not supposed to kill birds of prey. But windmill can kill a bird of prey, multiple birds of prey. And that's okay because it's windmills. So there's a lot of hypocrisy. I just wanted to point that one out.
Well, and what about the Keystone Pipeline drilling off the coast? I mean, where are we at on that? I know that energy is one of your favorite topics to talk about.
Keystone Pipeline, we should have that. Canada's our largest and best trading partner, but Canada has had enough of the United States.
Well, why are they waiting?
They're not. They're moving east. They've already turned loose the money and building the pipeline to go from the oil sands in Canada east to the ports there. They're not going to send it to China. They've already made the decision. It's not coming to the U.S. either. We lost those jobs, 500,000 construction jobs and long-term jobs. That was a loss. So
there's no sense even talking about the XL pipeline anymore?
I don't think
Keystone
so.
Pipeline?
I don't think Keystone XL is on the table anymore, based on what I've heard from Canada just recently. Drilling off the coast of South Carolina, one bit of progress we have there is we work with the Department of Interior over their environmental impact study to allow seismic work to happen off the coast. So you're going to start seeing some seismic leases happen so we can drag some 21st century seismic out there and really try to discover what resources may or may not be present, instead of looking at 30-year-old seismic graphs and trying to figure out whether there were any resources or not.
Are there resources out there?
We believe they are, and a lot of folks believe there's more than you can imagine. We'll see. We hadn't had any seismic activity out there. Not seismic activity from earthquakes and all.
You mean like Edgefield?
No seismic work has been done in over 30 years, and so we need to use that 21st century technology and actually allow seismic work to happen out there so we can see. And once we do see, then we can make a great argument at that point in time. If there are harvestable resources there, then we can make a great argument to move to the next step and have a lease sale and actually put Americans and South Carolinians to work in the energy sector.
But what about destroying the coast, the view, and everything?
Well, you know, if you stood in the ocean at Isle of Palms, you walk straight out to where these resources are. First off, you're in 120 feet deep water. You're over the visible horizon, so you're not going to see an oil or gas platform out there. You're going to have to get in a boat to go out there to see them. And if you do get in a boat, take a fishing ride, because they're great fisheries. They're fish enhancers. You go to the Gulf of Mexico and go fishing. Where they're going to go fishing is around the rigs. But it's in 120 feet deep water. So how is what we're going to do off the coast of South Carolina different than what happened in Louisiana off the coast with Deepwater Horizon? Well, the fact is that was deep water, 5,600 feet, 1 mile below the surface. So man can't dive down. The water temperatures, the pressure, and the temperature is just not, you're not able to do that hands-on. So you had to do it with robotics to try to cap this gusher. off the coast of South Carolina, 120 feet deep. God forbid anything happen off the coast from a oil spill or a blowout, but if it did happen, it would be short-lived because they wouldn't have to wait on a specialized ship to come from Nova Scotia with a robot and a guy up on the surface with a PlayStation controller looking at a TV screen trying to operate a robot to cap that gusher. Somebody put on a diamond suit, jump overboard, take the wrenches and a blowtorch and whatever they needed and deal with it hands-on, 120 feet deep from here to my car out in the parking lot. And so if he's down there and he's working and he realized, well, I brought a 7/16 and that's a 3/8 inch bolt. Hey, radio to the surface, drop off a 7/16 inch wrench and they drop it overboard and deal with it hands-on right there. And that's the difference. It'll be taken care of a lot quickly. So we've learned a lot. We've got all the staging ability with the equipment. They can do something about it now.
What about energy independence? Are we going to get there?
We should. We're moving there. We're seeing now. We're seeing Saudi, I think, make a play to try to limit our energy independence. They're keeping their production levels up. You're seeing the price of the pump go down. It's supply and demand. Global demand's down due to the economy, and supply is up, and so energy prices come down. Saudi is keeping that supply up versus cut. Normally, they would cut production to support the price. They're not doing that, and so I think they're trying to hurt what's going on in the Bakken. I also think we need to sell our oil on the global market. We've surpassed Saudi Arabia in the amount of oil we produce here, but we're limited on who we can sell it to outside of the U.S.
Why is that?
We ought to do away with that law.
Why
and
is that?
Put it out. It goes back to old laws, and we weren't producing much, and the idea was to keep all we produced and use it here at home.
Oh, okay.
Well, now we're producing more than anybody else. So I believe if you put it out on the global market, then you increase global supply to meet global demand, and that drives the price down. It's a supply and demand, simple economics.
Isn't it great that supply and demand still works after all these years?
You're seeing it right now at the pump, and you should go to my Facebook page, join me on Facebook, friend me there, and look. It's a great article about that I posted, I think, yesterday about supply and demand and why we're seeing the price changes at the pump now.
You know, we're almost out of time, but I did want to make a comment. You know, all the indicators are saying because the price of gas is down that people will be spending more on Christmas. I find that highly bizarro that we would think that that's what it would be when people are just being able to maybe go out to eat or supply something else for their home that they really need, but that Christmas is going to be great this year because the price of gas is down.
Well, we'll see, but I will say this. Every 50-cent drop in the price of gas, and we've seen over 50 cent in the last couple of weeks, yields about $10 per 20-gallon fill-up. That's real money.
Yes,
that's
yes.
Real money that mom and dad have, regardless of how they spend it, whether they hold it and spend it at Christmas at Sharp Facets or whether they spend it at McDonald's or J. Peter's. It doesn't matter. The indicators say they're going to spend that money. They're not going to save it. And so that's got to be a boost to the retailers in this economy.
Absolutely. Well, Jeff Duncan, you got 2 minutes to tell the people why they should send you back to Washington again.
Well, for the last 4 years, I've focused on three main things: jobs, energy, and the Founding Fathers. What can we do to unleash and unbridle the innovative and entrepreneurial spirit to help Americans create jobs with the understanding that government creates jobs, they create government jobs. 57,000 are sitting on the sidelines right now at home for disciplinary actions, about $800 million cost to the U.S. taxpayer. We need to help Americans create American jobs. We do that by less government. Energy is a segue to job creation, and I can simply point to North Dakota and Oklahoma and Texas and Louisiana. Low unemployment in those states because they're energy states. Energy is a great segue to job creation, and we just talked about putting money back in the economy by lessening your energy cost. I think it's important. Our founding fathers, limited government, free markets, and individual liberties. It's a formula that works. We ought to return to the United States Constitution, something I believe second only to the to the Holy Bible. Is the United States Constitution, and so I think we ought to return to what our founders envisioned: limited government, free markets, individual liberties as a working combination. Jobs, Energy, and the Founding Fathers is an acronym that spells Jeff, and I think it's a positive message for returning this government back to the people.
Well, Jeff Duncan, it's always a pleasure, and it's been too long. Thank you for coming by and sitting down with us this afternoon.
Thanks so much. I love Ann, and I love the show, and I look forward to being back in your studio soon.
All right. Thank you so much. Hey, we're going to join the news in progress. Don't you go away. We got Jill Bossie that's going to be joining us with the American Party running against Senator Lindsey Graham.